Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello. You're listening to BFN. This is the podcast about infertility, IVF, and the trials of trying for a baby. I'm Emma.
And I'm Gabby, and we're both card-carrying members of the Infertility Club. What's Tuesday?
We sound very unenthusiastic, mate.
Really? I thought that was quite enthusiastic.
We need to ramp up our enthusiasm.
It's Tuesday, guys! Another Tuesday.
It's Tuesday!
In lockdown. Whoop, 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 whoop.
Tuesday for me has always been the worst day of the week. Fact.
No. Well, that's surely the podcast improves that, no?
Yeah. I mean, it's fine.
Yes.
But we do get nice comments on a Tuesday.
Yes, we do. It's great. Our Tuesdays are filled with light and joy.
Well, that's partly why I thought we should do this on a Tuesday, because I find Tuesdays too depressing.
And so we could say, otherwise, see you next Tuesday.
And yeah, I mean, that's obviously the primary reason.
Yeah. How you doing, mate?
Do you know what? I've been thinking, I spent the last 3 days being like, what am I going to talk about on the podcast this week? And the answer is, I have nothing to talk about.
Oh, wow.
I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine.
Okay.
I am fine.
Oh, good.
But there's nothing to talk about because nothing's happened. Because
nothing happens. Yeah,
still.
I know. It's boring.
I'm so bored.
What's the best thing you've eaten over the last 7 days?
I had some dairy-free ice cream.
Yeah?
But it doesn't taste like real ice cream, so it was shit.
Oh, mate.
Sorry, that's not the best thing I've eaten over the last 7 days. I also found some dairy-free Roquefort cheese.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Oh. Oh, God.
It's so
mate,
bad.
Should we... I'm sorry that you've had such an uninspiring week.
It's just so boring. Do you know what? I'll tell you what I've been trying to do. I've been looking for a good texturizing spray.
Oh, so you can have... sea salt kissed hair.
Yeah, well, I want YouTube hair. I've decided I want hair like YouTubers. Oh, and the other thing I've done, I learned to crochet.
Yes, I saw that.
I'm not
cool.
Good at crocheting, but I've made like 8 granny squares and now I've run out of wool, so I'm gonna have to get some more.
That's the sexiest thing you've ever said.
How are you?
Yeah, so I have a sty in my eye.
Oh, that's the sexiest thing you've ever said.
Oh yeah, I've got a sty just for you. Yeah, it's really painful and I look like Quasimodo and I'm just not happy about it basically. It's ruining my weekend.
Ow.
Yeah, it's really sore and horrible.
I'm so sorry. And
I was like, I've got coronavirus in my eye. But I don't think that's what it is. I think it's just a regular bog standard sty.
Oh, God.
And so that's fun.
I can't believe we're trying to run a podcast when literally nothing is happening to us and we have nothing to talk about.
Oh, the other thing that happened is that yesterday I went to the park, as we all do now, because it's the only thing we're allowed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband bought me a cider and I drank it. And then afterwards, after I drank this one bottle of cider, I was like, God, I feel fucking wasted. And looked at how the percentage alcohol was like 8.5% alcohol. I was like, Jesus Christ, no wonder I'm pissed.
That's brilliant.
Oh, mate. So I ended up getting a hangover at like 5 o'clock and I was in such a bad mood.
I hate that.
It was awful. Yeah. So that's happened.
I've got to say lockdown has caused me to drink way more than I have in a long, 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 long time. Like since before I started IVF. And it's taught me that drinking is not that great.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been grateful for my evening wines, for sure.
Evening wines are good, but like day drinking.
Yeah, day drinking. Poor Mr. Gabby got a right earful. I was like a spoilt, petulant brat yesterday because I was in such a shitty hangover mood. I felt so sorry for him afterwards. I am a C-U-N-T. Anyway.
Should we talk about the show as we have nothing else to discuss? So I loved editing this show. And by loved, what I mean is I cried my eyes out.
Oh, man, yeah. Zoe has quite the story, doesn't she?
So you've spoken to Zoe Clark Coates.
Yes, exactly. She is, an author. She runs a charity called the Mariposa Trust, which has something called Saying Goodbye, which is basically they organise services of remembrance for babies that have been lost, and they do it in cathedrals, which is really incredible. I think basically it's amazing what they do for bereaved parents. Uh-huh. And so she has her own story of loss and grief, yeah, which is a real roller coaster. So yeah, I had a really nice chat with her about a month ago.
What I thought was really interesting about the interview is because she's talking a lot about pregnancy and pregnancy loss and then pregnancy after pregnancy loss, I thought it might be a bit triggery, but it doesn't, to me, it didn't feel triggery at all. Like, obviously, if you're in a very, very kind of delicate state right now, maybe don't listen to it, but I found it quite cathartic to listen to. And just, you know, we say this so often, but she really articulates what she's been through so beautifully.
Yeah, agreed. Definitely. And I think, you know, obviously pregnancy, people getting pregnant, a lot of the time we don't want to talk about that. We don't want to hear about it. But also, mm-hmm, it happens a lot in our community that people get pregnant after they've had a loss. And so yeah, I think she kind of laid out a few kind of basic tips that I think would be helpful for anyone that this happens, yeah, to, really.
Because it is such an anxious time. And, you know, I did an Instagram post after I'd edited it because I've been thinking about it so much, about how upsetting I find it that people in our community, I mean, the for the large part, aren't going to be able to enjoy pregnancy like, you know, I'm doing little air quotes, but normal people. Because you do have that anxiety following you around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So there's that interview. As Emma has said a number of times, get your tissues.
Yeah, definitely have a box of tissues at the ready. That's all.
Grab your Kleenex.
Yeah. And then we spoke to Professor Tim Child, Medical Director of Oxford Fertility, and he is talking about the difference between long and short protocols today.
Which is about time, actually, because I don't know the difference.
No,
I don't know.
Oh my God, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that in a bit, but some confusing shit there. And
the foxes, what have the foxes been up to?
Well, they've kind of, they're bringing a literary flavour this week. Kind of a book review, really.
Oh, awesome.
Like a funky book review. So yeah, and they're kind of thinking a bit more about adoption and what that means and stuff like that. Guys, just to say, you know, if you're listening to this and if you're, what do they used to say on TV shows? If you're experiencing the same issues.
Yes.
It might be worth checking out The Hangout, which is run by Kat Strawbridge, who's been on the show a couple of times.
Yes. The Finally Pregnant Hangout, which is, it's a membership community for men and women who are finally pregnant and parenting.
Yep. So you can find that by going to, well, checking out the Finally Pregnant podcast is a good first step.
It is. It's a great podcast, so you should.
It is. We've been on it.
We have.
You can also go to Kat's Instagram, which is Trying Years.
Or you can go to katstrawbridge.com because there's a little tab telling you all about it. And basically, you can receive support. They do lots of lives and you can participate in a monthly online support group. So get on it. I suppose that just leaves us to say I hope you all enjoy the podcast.
Yes, please rate, review, like and subscribe or whatever your preferred verb is.
And follow us on some social media.
Yes, you can. You can follow us on Instagram.
At Big Fat Negative.
You can follow us on Facebook.
Big Fat Negative.
You can follow us on the Twitters.
At Big Fat Negative.
And you can email us.
BigFatNegativePodcast@gmail.com. Do you know what? I'm going to actually change it. I'm going to sneak in and change our Twitter handle one day just so we can say something different there. Just to spice it up a bit.
Okay. Well, I'll await that.
Good.
You can do it as a
Everyone
fun surprise.
Will, I'm sure. Yeah. Yes, exactly. When's it going to happen, guys?
In the meantime, please enjoy the show.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Why are you laughing?
Because this is the second time we've had this conversation.
You didn't have to tell them that.
Well, you didn't press record.
Well, I'm sorry. I just couldn't get the staff these days. Anyway, what have you been up to this week?
I read a book.
You did?
I did. And it wasn't forced upon me at all.
I can't think of the word. That would have been really good if I'd been really quick off the mark there.
Yeah.
Didn't sound forced at all.
Smooth.
Would you like to tell us about this book?
It's a book called No Matter What.
Right.
An adopted family's story of hope, love and healing by Sally Donovan.
Why did we read this book?
Because it's about adopted kids. And someone's experience.
Yeah, so a bit of background really, and I don't actually know if Nick is aware of this.
Probably not, that's why I'm a bit bemused.
Bamboozled. Basically, my friend Claire, hi Claire, is doing her PhD in adoption. And when we mentioned that we were interested in looking at adoption as an option, she recommended that we read this book. And I was a bit unsure, I think, to start off with, because I wasn't really sure how much I'd get from it. But actually, having been to the adoption information evening and feeling like I was quite disconnected from the whole thing, I was actually quite keen to read somebody's first account from it, because yeah. I hoped that it would give us a bit more of an insight into actually what it's like.
Yeah. Indeed.
What did you think about it?
I was a bit like you, reluctant to read, because reading is something I do for pleasure, and this felt a bit like homework.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it. It was really interesting. Well, I enjoyed, not necessarily the right... Well, it's an eye-opening book, isn't it?
Definitely. I think, for me, you know, like I said, I felt really disconnected from the information evening, and so I really wanted to kind of understand a bit more about what it's really like. And yeah, both Nick and I are quite big readers. So I felt a bit like you. I stopped and started with it a couple of times because I didn't feel like I was in the right headspace to really get enough, you know, as much as I needed from it. But yeah, I definitely was really hungry to kind of get through it, because I felt like I was really invested in the lives of the people.
Yeah,
that were
I
in
got
the
very invested in it. I think you just want to know, because they have they obviously have quite a hard time, because the kids come from a traumatic background. But there's always interspersed with those sort of really happy times, and you just want to see what becomes of them all.
Yeah, and I think it's not sugar-coated at all.
No,
you know, it was very raw in places. And I think it's quite interesting because, I don't know if anybody's read it, but they discovered that they would need some help in conceiving, and very quickly made the decision that IVF just was not for them. So I think they were in quite a unique position.
They never even went for a round, did they?
No, so definitely in a very different position to us. So I think I'd hoped to be able to read about a story similar to ours, in that they'd maybe gone through IVF and had made the decision to move away from that, or choose a different path. And I didn't quite get that, but definitely got a better understanding about the realities, I guess, of becoming an adoptive parent.
Yeah. This, you've got to see so little experience you can gain, I suppose, until you really go through it. But I suppose when you get from the adoption night, you, like you said, it was a real whistle-stop tour of what to expect, and I suppose you get more into it the further you go into it. But that was a case study, if you like, of someone's experience of adoption, because they adopted slightly. Was it the boy was about 3?
I think so. Yeah.
And the daughter was about 1-ish.
Yeah, 18 months-ish. I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, similar to what I foresee us doing if we went down that road.
Mm.
Which I think, again, is why I felt quite invested in it.
Yeah.
Were there any kind of particular moments that really struck you?
You've got... Obviously, you have the anger that the boy has at times, and he's aware of it. He's very aware of when he's mean to his mum. Mm. But he just can't control it.
Yeah.
And then that's... I like to focus on the happier part. It's like a really nice... ending, sort of where they're all sort of where they go to like watch him in a school production, and he's just like the life of the performance, really, and just sort of showing his growth a bit through a, like, what, 10 years of positive family life, really.
Yeah.
And then so the just stark realities are the, because you've got the, they don't go into much detail about the physical abuse.
No,
they went into, but it was more the, there's a few bits when the birth mother sends a memory box to the daughter but not the son.
Yeah.
And you think that's just so cruel.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's an extension, I guess, of the cruelty that he's already experienced.
And like that they were more fight, because they're all throughout the early part, particularly the book, the birth parents are kicking up a stink, really, aren't they, about them being adopted, and they send some letters to the parents and like addressing them as like their temporary carers, like real poignant. They're, you know, just deliberately trying to undermine them. And but even that was, they were more interested in getting the daughter back, weren't they?
Yeah.
Which is really sad.
It was really sad. And actually, there were a couple of things that really stood out for me, in that I, you know, obviously having seen friends have children and things, you recognise that parenting is difficult. And, you know, our nephew has Down syndrome, and you have a kind of secondhand, you know, we have secondhand kind of not like information from your parents about the support, the extra support that he needs is, you know...
it's just parent at a different side of parents, and they have
it
to...
what I'm saying is it's a battle with authorities, with schools, always to make sure that he's getting every support that he needs. And I kind of got the feeling that it's very much the same with adoption, and in this situation is that sometimes you have to prepare to have a bit of a fight on your hands. And I don't know if that's kind of general parenting, and it probably is, from, like, a lot of people would say, actually, no, that's just, you know, we've all got a bit of a battle. But certainly for me, it just really struck me how much of a fight she had to
put with the initial support worker they were given shortly after they adopted. And then in comparison to the new one they get, where she's really good.
Yeah, and I think just with the school, and, you know, they have to move schools because he's just not getting the, you know, the little boy's not getting the support.
Needs. And I think it was interesting, the other people's views that, oh, he's been with you for like 3 years now, he should be over this.
Yeah, he should be better.
That thought, which was, and you think these people are like in education, you sort of think, maybe they should know a bit more about different struggles. That, I think that was shocking. And hopefully that's just individual teachers.
And bearing in mind, this was written some, what, 10 years ago?
A bit longer than that.
A bit longer than that. So I think, you know, we're looking at it from a fixed point in time, I guess. But I remember you saying before that you felt as though you had quite a rose-tinted view of adoption, and you felt that you needed to have that reality check a bit.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this book gave you that?
A bit. I still can't help focus on the positive sides of stuff. Yeah. And I think it's... I don't think I could ever quite know what it's like unless you're living in it.
No.
Because you're only reading about these sections where what she's actually talking about is years.
Yeah.
So I don't think you can wrap your head quite around that from just reading there. It certainly gives you experience of how hard it is.
Mm.
But you can't, unless you know, unless you're living through it. You're just reading about somewhat like different sections of people's lives within a few pages.
I guess it's quite difficult as well because obviously having gone through years of infertility, like that presents its own set of challenges and is its own battle. So it's that question of having seen a snapshot of how difficult it could be for somebody, you have to make that decision as to whether or not you're ready to continue that battle if you've got that like strength in you, and I guess if you want to be a parent that's how it's going to be.
I think it's the early parts of the book where they're talking about their infertility struggles, it's almost a little bit reassuring. It's always a bit reassuring to read someone else's having had the same experience, because you can read and go, I know what she's talking about. I can relate to that.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's well written, and like I read it quite quickly in the end.
You did, and you're someone who likes to take your time over books. So I was quite surprised. And normally I can tell when you're really enjoying something, in that you constantly want to have chances to read it. Mm. And this was definitely one of those for you, I think.
Yeah, like I said, I think you just want to see that they're all right in the end.
Yeah, I think she has written other books, but I think they're more like therapeutic parenting books, which probably would be better for us further down the line, potentially.
It'd be nice for her to have a sort of almost like a sequel, because I would like to know what becomes of them and the kids and where they are now. Because they must be, I'm sure we worked it out, like the son must be about 20 by now.
Yeah. And hopefully, you know, it's... Like you said, they've had the positive experiences have continued, but it was definitely like, for me, I definitely felt like it was as difficult or would be as difficult or even more so than I anticipated, I think. And there were certainly elements that I felt really emotionally connected to it, and definitely parts where I got quite upset reading. Not necessarily about what had happened, because they don't go into massive detail about that, and it's not really relevant, but more so just the reactions of the children to certain things that were happening. And, you know, you could definitely feel her frustration in the sort of more challenging behaviours. And so I just think it gave me definitely more of an emotional connection to a child's children who have been in trauma.
Yeah.
So I think for me it definitely... was a bit of an eye-opener, but certainly not in a bad way.
No. I think there's different parts where it's like... you feel a bit of relief when he goes to the new school and he seems to be getting on better.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're that invested, I think, in him and, you know, wanting him to do well. And I guess you would hopefully transfer that onto any adoptive children that we had. But you definitely felt like that's... success when he
you're willing that when they have a good day when you really feel the success in that,
and that must be like amazing feeling for them. You kind of really got that sense,
because there's a few moments where I can't remember where it's like a family get together and he's almost like leading it. He's sort of different kids, like really confident and happy, and it's the same with that performance he does at the end, and that must be a really rewarding experience.
Yeah, the sense of achievement that you must feel having given that child that extra confidence, yeah, and that, you know, life to feel that way must be amazing.
And on the bits where he recognises when he's being angry, and I think that must be a sign of growth.
Yeah, definitely.
He knows he gets angry and he doesn't know how to stop it, and she can discuss it with him, and I suppose it doesn't, because it is really, some parts are really quite shocking, aren't they? How he's
very aggressive, yeah, isn't he? Yeah, and I think
and it turns really quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, and you definitely get the sense, or it's almost reinforced, because obviously, you know, they did speak about this in the adoption information evening, that it's very much child-centred. You know, it's very much about the child. Mm. And certainly when they get the social worker who is more invested, she's very much, you know, focused on the children and how they're doing, and it's not so much about you. So I guess you kind of have to realise and recognise and be able to take that step back, because even though you're part of the bigger picture, it's kind of not about you.
No.
And it's really hard, like, to recognise that and to realise that that might be something that you could do, given that having gone through IVF, it kind of is all about you.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, so you've kind of gone from, like, a really, you know, me-focused or us-focused time to actually this is about someone else. And I guess, to a degree, that is the transition into parenting, but you're so focused on the IVF element.
Yeah,
You know, like we said before, it's a bit like when you get married and you get really focused and hung up on the wedding, and then you kind of almost forget that, oh yeah, we have married life after this. Yeah. You know, actually,
that's the best part.
It is the best part. I really hope it's the same with parenting, although it sounds very stressful. Yeah. But yeah, is there anything else that you'd like to say about the book?
I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I do. And I think it's a really good read. It's a really interesting read. And not only is it informative, just by way of the process, it does definitely give an emotional insight into adoptive family life. And it's quite raw in places. I think it is.
But I think overall it's quite positive.
Definitely. It's not a negative read at all. It's... It ends very positively. Sorry, spoilers. But it doesn't shy away from the difficult elements, I don't think.
No.
So, yeah, bringing a bit of literary flavour to BFN this week.
Next week, Harry Potter.
And it will contain spoilers. But, yeah, hope you all have good weeks. And we'll speak to you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Oh, yeah.
thank you so much for joining us. We start every interview by asking our interviewees to tell us about their journey. So, Zoe, tell me about your journey.
Okay, so my journey is the fact that I went through baby loss. So going back a little further, me and my husband are successful business owners. We're international PR and event experts and love working together. Mm. Have been married for quite a long time before we decided to have children. And when that time came, we just presumed it would all be fine and it would all be okay. My sister had had children with no problems at all. Now, I was totally aware of baby loss because I'm a trained counsellor. I trained in it because my mum is a therapist.
Okay.
And what had really pushed me into doing it was not only my mum being a therapist, it was also because one of my best friends had had two stillbirths and miscarriages. And so I journeyed that with her. So I'd trained. So I was aware of baby loss, but just didn't think it would ever happen to me.
Of course, I don't think anyone does.
No, you just think that you'll just sail through. You can choose to have children when you want. I always say you spend so much of your time trying not to get pregnant until you want to get pregnant. And then you realise the fact that, you know, the stars need to align in a specific way for everything to even happen.
It's actually really hard.
It's so hard, but you're just not taught that, are you?
No.
Even at school or anything, you're just made to believe that it just happens when you want it to happen.
Yeah, 100%.
So we decided to try and we're really blessed to get pregnant, and but quickly lost that baby through a miscarriage. We kind of didn't even process the loss, to be honest. I was so determined not to be one of those statistics and to have gone through loss, so we almost pretended it didn't happen.
Right.
And I said, let's just try again, let's not even think about it. And we were blessed to get pregnant again, and this time it just felt so different to that first pregnancy, which we saw as a very good sign. And I went for my first scan. Everything was great. And after that scan, I started to bleed. But they'd actually warned me that that might happen at that scan because they'd seen some old blood in my womb. And they said, don't panic if that ever starts to come out. Which, of course, I did. As soon as I started to bleed, I was terrified. Any pregnant woman, no. I know, even if you're warned about it, it's still terrifying. But I kind of tried to deep breathe through it and just willed it to stop, and eventually it started to settle. And so we saw that as a good sign. I actually got the flu then, which wasn't great timing, and so I was pretty bedridden with the flu. And then the bleeding started again, and I ended up going for an emergency scan, and that showed that our daughter Darcy was absolutely fine. She was all happy. It was all great. So that brought some peace, but the bleeding increased 24 hours later.
Right.
And I ended up in A&E, who were really dreadful. And they actually asked me why I was so upset. Was it because we paid for our baby and it was an IVF baby? And it that really shocked us because it totally removed our permission to be sad about it, to be grieving about it. And we were still hoping everything was okay, but just to be asked why you're upset. And it was shocking.
Yeah, that is shocking. I mean, you'd hope that that must be so rare, because even common sense tells you not to say that to someone.
Yeah, you'd think. They couldn't do anything and they couldn't scan. And they told me the earliest they could give me a scan was in a week's time.
Oh, wow.
And to just go to bed and just presume everything was okay. Which clearly you can't do when you're so terrified. So we left numbers, messages on lots of different clinics, AMPS machines on the Sunday. And on the Monday morning, I got a call from one of the clinics saying, come straight over to us now and we will scan you.
Right.
And that was such a horrible drive. And I was up one moment thinking everything's going to be okay. And the next moment thinking I need to prepare myself for awful news here. And we went to the clinic, got the scan, and it was quite an advanced clinic. So instead of just having a small screen, they had a massive screen on the wall opposite us. So we were watching that and we could instantly see her on the screen. So that just gave us such reassurance. And but the sonographer, the midwife who was doing the scan, she didn't really speak and she was really quiet. And and then we noticed that she wasn't moving on the screen. And then we just looked at her and said, is everything okay? And she just stayed silent. And and then she said, I'm really, really sorry, but she's passed away. And it was awful. I mean, such an awful moment.
Yeah, I can't even imagine how awful.
Yeah, and we begged for another scan, and a consultant came in and he did another scan. And basically, we were given choices of what to do. We decided to wait to go into natural labour, which is what I did. And I delivered her at home. And
that is
horrible.
Incredible. Yeah, how did you get through that?
It was hard and it was black and it was dark. And I'd had to go for a scan in the middle of the next week. So I was waiting for labour to start. And I'd asked that midwife who'd done the scan, have you ever seen a baby come back to life? And she said to me, I remember one case I read once where someone was told the baby had died. And then when they went back, the baby was alive. And so I was like, right, that's going
to
be me.
I'll hold on to that.
The second person.
Yeah.
And so for those days in between, I was just praying constantly that she would come back to life. And so we went in a few days later for another scan. And she'd actually grown. And that shocked me because the blood carries on going to the baby and everything. But her heart was still not beating. And and so that's where all hope then left. That this was it and it was over. And my parents had come and were staying with us by then, and we'd just all just sit and cry and stare out the window. And it was coming up to Christmas, and so I remember just sitting staring at all of the neighbours' Christmas lights, and it just felt so surreal. And just waiting for labour to start. And I went into labour exactly a week later.
Right.
And delivered her. And, yeah, it was horrible and traumatic, but also beautiful. And people really struggled knowing even what to say to me in that week, because there is something really weird about knowing somebody is pregnant and their baby's not alive anymore. So they're still pregnant, but the baby's not kind of there. And I remember a friend saying to me, isn't it horrible? Isn't it? I don't understand. I don't understand how you can be okay and just living with having a dead baby inside you. And I remember saying to her, it's still my baby.
Yeah, of course.
It's still my baby. I don't love her any less than when her heart was beating. And
you just have it. You have more time with her.
The timing. Yeah, absolutely. And the thought of actually going into labour was scary, and the unknown, and it was going to be the end of my time with her. So I was okay waiting. It wasn't. Some people find it, they need to get it sorted immediately and go into surgery. Yeah. And I get that. But that just wasn't my story at that time. I didn't mind that wait. And it gave me time mentally to deal with the fact that she died. And so, yeah, I didn't know how I would recover, but somehow we did. And got pregnant again. And that was so exciting. And I remember going to, I so didn't believe the pregnancy tests. I'd done so many of them. I went to the pharmacy, I went to Boots, and you know, they've got that. If you want to speak to the pharmacist in private, we have a little room at the back.
Yeah.
So I was like, I need to speak to you in private. Right. So I dragged this guy, this pharmacist, into the private room, and I got out all my pregnancy tests out of the bag and laid them all in front of him. And I went, am I pregnant? He was like, yes, you're pregnant.
I think you
and
are.
And I was just like, I think you are pregnant. And it, because I just so didn't believe them. Mm. And so that was really exciting and sadly ended in another miscarriage.
Oh, awesome.
And so the first was obviously a miscarriage. The second was a missed miscarriage. The third was then a miscarriage. And then when life was so utterly crap, we'd got a dog who was, anyone who is an animal lover will know, dogs can be equal family members. And we'd had our dog through most of our married life. And then he suddenly got sick and died one afternoon.
Oh, no. That's
too much.
And
that kind of finished me off. Oh, yeah, I mean, it really did finish me off. I was just like, nope. I cannot do this anymore. And that's when we had our drive of madness. And me and Andy just didn't know what to do. And I said, I just can't be in the house.
No.
It feels awful. Our dog not just walking around. The house felt so quiet. So we just got in the car and we started to drive. And we drove to the top of Scotland.
Right.
And we cried all the way. We talked, we cried, and we'd stop at hotels, just sleep, get back in the car, carry on driving. And then when we got to the top of Scotland, Andy said, what do you want to do now? Do you want to get a ferry abroad? Because we'd taken our passports. Wow. And I said, no, let's just drive back. Because the vet, who was a friend of ours, I said, he'll be phoning us up to collect Jake's ashes, the dog's ashes. So let's go home. So we drove all the way back crying. And again, another completely surreal time. And because of losing Jake, the dog, and then the three losses, when I was then late with my period, I didn't think anything of it. I just thought it's stress.
Yeah.
It's the fact that we've been driving and we have not really eaten well and everything.
Yeah,
so,
of course.
But I suddenly thought, what if I'm pregnant? What if I'd got pregnant before Jake had died and I've just not even realised it?
Mm.
And went and did a pregnancy test and it was positive.
Oh, wow.
And I just couldn't believe it. And we immediately contacted our consultant.
Yep.
And he was just like, just avoid all stress. And I was like, that's not possible. Let me tell you what we've just done. We've just driven to the top of Scotland and I haven't eaten hardly at all for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I've just cried for 2 weeks. And he was just like, don't worry about it. It's something we tell people, but actually the worry really won't make much difference at all. And that pregnancy went all the way through and we ended up bringing our little girl home.
Oh, how
wonderful. So that is Esme Emilia Promise, who is now 11 years old.
Wow.
And and we just adored being parents, and we'd only ever planned to have one child.
Mm.
But as I came out of theatre because I had a C-section, I was saying, oh, it's a shame she's not a twin. And because it'd be so nice to have two.
Yeah.
And
the sibling was already in mind.
I know. But I'd still kept saying, no, but we'll only still have one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But by the time she was about 1.5, we were started talking about, should we have more? She'd started to really love playing with other children. And it felt like the right thing to do, and our heart just completely changed and we decided we desperately wanted another child.
Right. Okay.
So we tried for another child and we're really blessed to get pregnant with Samuel. And again, everything was going great. Mm-hmm. I was going for regular scans just to make sure everything was okay. And on one afternoon there was Andy, myself and Esme all in the room with the doctor. And the scan started and we could see Samuel on the screen And then Chris, our consultant, just went silent. And and I just, that's exactly what I said. I said, not again.
Yeah.
And he said his heart stopped beating.
Sorry.
And so we were back there all over again. And Esme was sitting there watching the screen.
Oh.
And it was just horrible. So I just asked if I could just take a few minutes out. And I just went into their bathroom and just screamed and slid down the wall.
I mean, and, imagine having to deal with it with Esme as well must have just added a layer of complexity that's just...
Oh, it was horrible.
Mm.
And this time I didn't feel like I could choose to go the natural route. And have him naturally. It just felt, because of Esme, I couldn't wait a week. And I didn't want any added complications. So I decided to have surgery.
Right.
But the doctor who needed to do it was on holiday. And he was really kind to say he'd come back off holiday just to do the surgery for me.
Mm.
And I waited, I think, 3 or 4 days, maybe 5 or 6, and then went in to have the operation, and delivered him that way. And it was horrible. It was different. To every loss has been very different.
Yeah.
And I was shocked at how much I grieved, not only for myself but also for Esme, the fact that she was losing a brother,
of course.
What if this meant that we wouldn't be able to have more children.
Mm.
So that just added another dimension to the grief, really.
Yeah.
And
how did you communicate it with Esme?
Because she was so young, she kind of didn't truly grasp. And we just kept on saying, we're sad at the moment, but everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And hopefully one day you'll have a baby brother or sister. Mm. And family were really great, and they came and really spent time entertaining her where we could have those moments of just being together and screaming and crying in private, because I was so determined to keep all of it away from her.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And we, because I just wanted things to feel as normal as possible for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we navigated that one well, but it was really, really hard.
Mm.
But she definitely didn't come out scarred through it.
Yeah, well done.
Yeah, and that in itself felt like a real achievement at the time. Whatever we were going through, we definitely were able to protect her through it. And then we decided to try again once we'd got to a place where we just felt ready to face whatever life threw at us.
Mm-hmm.
And got pregnant. Everything was going great. And we decided to tell the whole family we were expecting on our Christmas Eve party that we have every year.
Okay.
And as soon as I told them, I then went up to the bathroom and started to bleed.
Oh.
So I was like, no, this can't be possible. This can't be possible. It's just like the worst Groundhog Day ever. And
you also feel like, I've jinxed it. I've told everyone.
I told everyone, and now everyone's going to be sad. And it was Christmas Eve, and it was just horrible. We got told within a few days we definitely miscarried.
Mm.
And so I just kept on saying, let's just give Esme a great Christmas. That's what we'll do, and we'll grieve after Christmas.
Mm.
Which obviously is okay to say, but it's not possible just to put everything on hold.
No.
But again, we just tried to keep everything as private as possible from her. And it was probably around January 2nd, I started to get really ill.
Mm-hmm.
And iller and iller and iller, until eventually I said, I need to see a consultant or something, because something is seriously wrong with me.
Yeah.
And we managed to get a private appointment. And during that scan, they said, well, you might have been told you've lost the baby, but they were wrong. You haven't miscarried.
What?
Yes,
wow.
I know. And so we'd gone through all of this grief to being told suddenly we were still pregnant. We'd never lost the baby. And then we were told we were actually having twins.
Oh, my God.
So we were just...
That's a curveball and a half.
I know. So we went from having no baby to having two babies.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was a whirlwind and nothing we could have prepared for.
Of course.
But the next scan we had showed the fact that one of the babies was a bit more developed than the other. So okay. Chris, our consultant, who we hadn't seen him the first time because we weren't in that area where he was when we had the scan, he just said, just be mindful that you might not come home with two babies here.
Okay.
And so that changed our thinking and we decided not to tell everyone we were expecting twins just in case that happened because we just didn't know how we would be able to verbalise it all. And so we just kept it to our really close friends and family who knew and just tried to navigate it week by week to see what would happen. But I got iller and iller.
Right.
Ended up having lots of complications and ended up being admitted into hospital.
Oh, gosh.
And they determined that my liver was, something was seriously going wrong with my liver and I had got gallstones and my gallbladder had adhered to other organs.
Just really don't need that. Do you?
No, definitely not what you want to hear when you're pregnant. And so I stayed in hospital for a while and eventually was let out on what they said was that they were going to try and keep me going until they delivered the children.
Yeah.
And at that point, they would try and do the surgery that I needed. But it quickly became evident that wasn't going to be possible. We sadly lost one of the twins, Isabella. And so I was then only carrying one baby. And they said that it just couldn't wait. I was going to die and she would die too. And so the only option to try and save me and the baby was to have surgery while pregnant. So they gave me one operation and to make sure what was wrong was exactly what they thought, which it was. And then a week later, I went in for the surgery.
Wow.
And had an operation while pregnant, which was terrifying.
I imagine.
Especially when the anaesthetist had come in just before me being taken to theatre. And they said, just so you know, we have no way of monitoring your baby during this operation. So we will just be looking after you and you've just got to hope your body keeps her safe.
How can you deal with that information?
Oh, it was so horrible. I remember him walking out the room and me just sobbing in Andy's arms.
Oh, I can imagine. Saying,
I just don't want to even go in there. But if I don't go in there, then she will definitely die and I will die.
Yeah.
And Esme won't have a mum and this is the only chance to keep this baby alive. So I've just got to trust. I've got a faith. I'm just going to believe that God will keep her safe. And it turned into a really complex, long operation that went on for hours and hours. And but I came out and there was complications after, but she survived.
She did.
And I survived. And,
thank goodness.
And we brought her home.
Oh, and what's her name?
When she was born months later by C-section. Oh. She's called Bronte Jemima Hope.
Oh, Bronte. Yeah. Oh, that's good. Yes. Good news.
Yeah.
Wow, you have been through so much. I think that's more than anyone could ever handle.
It's quite a journey and certainly not one that I would have ever thought I'd have been going through when you just, as I said before, just you think you can choose to have children and everything will just be okay. And whether your battle is infertility or loss or recurrent miscarriage or whatever it is, it's just not something you can prepare for.
Of course not. Of course not. Now, I think you've, as I say, you've been through so much, but what I'd really love to talk to you about is I guess pregnancy after loss and how you can navigate that, because that's obviously something that you've been through a lot. And I know that you're writing a book about it. So should we talk about that for a second?
Absolutely. And I think this was one of the areas that I really struggled in. And I was really glad I was a counsellor, actually, and had had all of that therapy training, because I was able to implement a lot of the skills I'd been trained in in my own life, which, while you're training, you're not ever really viewing it as something you will use yourself. You're very much viewing it as something you're utilizing to help other people through trauma and their experience. But it was something I absolutely depended on to survive pregnancy after loss, which nothing could have prepared me for it. Just like nothing could have prepared me for going through the loss, nothing could have prepared me for the actual trauma. And it was a trauma of pregnancy, after you've already had that trapdoor open and you've fallen, and then all innocence is taken from you in pregnancy, where you just presume everything's going to be okay. You suddenly are living in trepidation every single day of something going wrong. And it really is a battle of the mind to try and overcome that daily anxiety and fear, where 9 months feels like eternity. And everyone tells you, just take it a day at a time. But actually, a day at a time is just too much for most people. And it's overwhelming. So my first three books, my first two books are actually both baby loss support books. My third book is a general grief book for all loss, whether you have lost a partner or a sibling or a parent or grandparent or anything. And so when the publisher said to me, what do you want book four to be? It was just an easy answer. The fact that what I definitely want to be my fourth book is a pregnancy guide to help you navigate this really challenging terrain that nobody can really help you through. It's a very solitary experience. Even though you're a couple going through pregnancy, it's definitely something you battle in your head.
Well, as you say, and, it's in your mind. It's something you have to deal with and get through every day as it comes.
And so that comes out in November, which I'm really excited about, because it's something, as a charity CEO, one of our divisions is called Growing You, and that supports people through pregnancy after loss. And it's something we've been asked for so long, just a guide and a resource.
And I mean, I guess there's a sense that for many women that, that having experienced loss and to a degree infertility as well kind of robs you of enjoying a pregnancy. Is that something that you've experienced or that you've heard from people you've been talking to?
Absolutely. You definitely have your joy robbed, and there's a guilt in that as well, because all you want to do is embrace the pregnancy. You're so grateful to be pregnant because you know how fragile everything surrounding pregnancy is. So if you're pregnant, you want to be able to enjoy it, you want to be able to embrace it, and you want to say, yeah, I know I'm the one of the lucky ones. But at the same time, you're terrified that that pregnancy is going to end, and so you're also battling guilt the whole time as well. So you're full of fear, you feel guilty, and you have no clue what tomorrow may bring. And what totally took me by surprise was how fear seems to get into everything. And once that fear lever is pulled, everything becomes scary and everything becomes challenging. So whether that be work or anything, because everything almost becomes a trigger, but also you're scared of doing certain things in case that you know, makes you more at risk of losing. You don't want to be stressed. You don't want to do physical things that could cause problems. So every part of your life is affected by it.
Absolutely. Unbelievable. So, I mean, what are your tips for surviving that situation for others?
Well, the cliche is true. You do have to take it a day at a time. But as I said, that can be too much for some. So you've got to just take it an hour at a time. I'd always say allow yourself to feel what you feel. The biggest problem is when people say, I'm just not going to worry. I'm just going to enjoy it and then that becomes almost fight mentally to keep those negative thoughts away. And it's actually proven clinically the fact that the more you try not to do something, the more your brain tries to take you there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So actually, you've just got to give yourself permission to worry.
Yeah,
and say it's going to be okay. If I need to worry, I'll worry.
Yeah.
But then try not to allow your brain to take you too far down that path. So give yourself permission to say, it's okay to be frightened. It's okay to worry. And that fear and that worry is totally legitimate. Anyone would feel it. Mm. So I'm not silly for feeling it. I'm not dramatic for feeling it. It's totally normal and okay. Mm. But then try to stop yourself from spiraling. Mm-hmm. So I would, for instance, I would say, right, I'm going to have 5 minutes where I just think about what I'm worried about. I'm going to let my mind go there. But then at the end of that 5 minutes, I'm going to pull myself back and then say, but right now, everything's okay. Right now,
yeah,
as far as I'm aware, my baby is safe. My baby is okay. And mm-hmm. there is nothing wrong with it mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's going to stay like that for tomorrow. But right now, that's how it is. So I'm going to choose to believe that, choose to embrace it. And it's a conscious choice. And by doing a mixture of both of those things, by acknowledging the fear, saying it's okay to be there and you don't need to feel silly for it. And but then saying, but I will now make this choice to allow myself to enjoy it, to allow myself some peace. Mm. That's one of the big keys, I think, to getting through it.
Absolutely. One of the things that I've seen you talk about is something you call loo terror, which
yeah.
is something I absolutely understand. And, you know, I think myself and Emma both had lots of bleeding in early pregnancy. So that feeling of not wanting to go to the loo to see that blood. How would you describe loo terror? How does it impact people?
Well, this was something that through my work as CEO of the Mariposa Trust, mm-hmm. we support over 50,000 people a week. So we're hearing literally thousands of stories a day from people. And I started to look at the common threads that people were constantly talking about. And one of them was fear of going to the loo after they've gone through any sort of loss. Mm. And when I looked at my journey, my story, I realised that's where so much of my terror and fear really rested in as well, where I didn't want to go to the bathroom. I didn't want to. Every time I'd get up in the night, I'd be so scared of what if I see blood now in the night.
Yeah, I used to go for a wee in the dark at night just because I didn't want to know.
That's exactly what I started to do. And for some people, that's a great technique to actually help them through it. Other people say that actually increases their worry because then they're thinking, well, if I'm bleeding, I want to know about it. And so it's finding that your ways to navigate that, but it's all consuming. And I realised the fact that no one talked about loo terror. It's like this unknown subject apart from those who go through it. And then I decided to cover a few topics in posts, and this was one of them. And it went viral within half an hour because people were all saying, I thought it was just me.
Yeah.
I had no idea. This is a common thread globally with people. And so that's what I named it, loo terror. And it isn't only there when you're pregnant. I started to do a lot of research with different people. And once that behavior pattern sets in about being frightened about seeing blood, it actually can carry on after you're not pregnant anymore. Mm. And people can still have it during their normal monthly cycle when it comes back, that same wave of panic the moment they see blood, because it's entrenched that trauma in the brain.
It takes you back. It's almost PTSD, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is. And as soon as I started to openly talk about this, it just removed so much, almost stigma for a lot of people, because they thought that there was almost something mentally wrong with them. that they were experiencing this, that they thought it was so unique to them and that nobody else in the world would understand. And then as soon as you realise this is really common for everybody, or for the majority of people, it makes you just feel so less lonely when you're experiencing it. And I think as soon as you realise you're not the only one, it just changes the experience of it. It doesn't make it less bad, but it definitely makes it a less lonely experience.
No, absolutely.
And takes away the fear that you are the only person.
I suppose scans are another big kind of hurdle that you have to get through when you're pregnant and you're having these anxieties. How would you say you could approach scans in a way that's not going to completely throw you off mentally?
Yeah. Well, I'd always say, I cover this extensively in the book, The Pregnancy After Loss. And I've even got within that support section, a 7-day plan leading up to your scan to help you mentally prepare for it.
Yeah.
But my top tips would definitely be, always be really open with whoever is looking after you about your history.
Yeah.
And so you've got to be really vulnerable in that and explain what you've been through so they can tailor their support to you.
Yeah.
And sadly, a lot of people will see varying different people during their pregnancy and for scans. And so what I always recommend is writing up your story and putting it into your pregnancy notes. And if you don't want to then explain it every time and have to revisit that and possibly re-trigger even more trauma, you just say to whoever you're seeing, there's something in my notes that I'd really like you to read before we carry on talking. And just so they've got the full history of what you've been through, don't make it too long. You know, if you write 6 or 7 pages of A4, they're not going to have the time to read that. Yeah. So be brief about it, but put it there and highlight it, and say to anybody who's looking after you, please could they read it?
Yeah.
And that is the first big way of helping yourself through this, because the more you open up to those around you who are offering you medical support, the better they can give you care. Don't be afraid to ask for somebody else to look after you if you do receive not compassionate or great care. The NHS is really set up in that way. The fact that if you don't appreciate the care you're getting or don't think it's good or it's causing you more harm than good, to say, could I actually change to a different person looking after me? And that can really help people as well. And also know the fact that you can choose where you have your care. You can go to a different hospital if a certain place triggers things. It's okay to move to a different location and say, I'd rather have my care in that place rather than one where I've had loss previously happen.
We talked about communication just there. How about communication with your friends and family? Like, you had the experience of both telling people that you were pregnant and then having to tell them you'd lost the baby, and then also of keeping it secret. How do you think people can come to those decisions themselves on whether to tell people or not?
Yeah, well, I'm a big advocate of telling people you're pregnant the moment you pee on that stick. And I think the 12-week rule, one of our campaigns as a charity for years has been to break that, because it's actually a not so subtle way of telling people to not talk about loss. I mean, they actually say that don't tell anybody you're pregnant until after 12 weeks, just in case you lose your baby. So it's not even a subtle way of telling people not to talk about their pain and grief. It's really blatant.
Yeah.
So I'm a big believer in tell people the moment you feel ready to tell them. Now, for some people, they don't want to tell people until 12 weeks or 20 weeks or 24 weeks, and that's absolutely fine. But I hate the fact that some people do feel ready instantly to share that they're pregnant, and they don't feel that they can because of society judging them, that they're breaking the news too early. But actually, you get so much better support if people know you're pregnant, if the worst did happen, which hopefully it won't happen. Mm. But if it does, it's really hard to tell people retrospectively, look, I was pregnant, but I'm not pregnant now. Mm-hmm. This is what I've gone through. It's so much easier to share that news if they already knew you were pregnant. And they're also invested into that pregnancy the moment you've told them as well. So it means they support you in a different way because they are journeying with you as well. Mm. So I'd always encourage people to share their news as quickly as they feel comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And for some, that might mean sharing it with just a small group of people initially and then telling everybody else. But I just think the important thing is to feel that freedom because you just really need it. Whether nothing goes wrong, which we pray it never does for anybody, pregnancy is really challenging at the best of times, mm-hmm. let alone if you've gone through loss. And it's a time when you just need the support of people and that friendship and love around you to help cheer you on, because it's not easy growing a human, whatever your previous experience.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Zoe, I think that's all of my questions. I've kept you for long enough now. Can I just ask you before you go, just to give us a quick overview of the Mariposa Trust? Because I know you've touched on it a few times, but I think it'd be great to hear it in your own words, what it is that you guys do.
Yeah, so the Mariposa Trust is more widely known as Saying Goodbye. And Saying Goodbye is our primary support division for anybody who's gone through any type of baby loss or child loss up to losing a four-year-old. We support, as I said, over 50,000 people a week via international services of remembrance, befriending, support and campaigning. And then we've got many other divisions within the organisation, Growing You, which supports people through pregnancy after loss, Waiting For You for people who are choosing to go down the adoption route, and many other divisions. Another part of our work within the Mariposa Trust is Campaigning For Change. Mm. I'm actually seconded to government. I'm co-chair on behalf of the Health Secretary for the review into how we support people who lose a baby. And so that's part of my work as Amazing. Well, which is across the NHS and beyond, in looking how we can better support people in the UK who have gone through this real trauma. And the government are really aware of the fact that you might not be able to stop all loss, but just by being offered the right care and great care and compassionate care, that can really help people emotionally journey through loss. So that's part of my work as well, and the work of the Mariposa Trust.
It's incredible that you've turned your experience, which has been awful and traumatic, into something that helps so many women and their partners. So, you know, thank you from everyone. I think it's incredible. And thank you for your time, importantly. It's been great to speak to you today.
Thank you.
Now it's time for
IVF.
What the F? We're talking about protocols.
We are talking about protocols. Long ones, short ones,
ghost
medium
ones.
Medium ones? No.
What's
such
ghost
thing
protocol?
As medium.
I think it's a Mission Impossible film.
Ah, well, we should all watch that too.
Yeah, you won't learn
about
IVF.
What else are we doing?
Professor Tim does not feature in that.
No, he doesn't. Although he is like Tom Cruise, isn't he? I bet he runs as fast as Tom Cruise.
I bet he can climb vertically up buildings and does all his own stunts.
Yeah, he definitely does his own stunts.
Don't think he's a Scientologist though.
Yes, so long and short protocols, what does it mean? What the F? Why are we doing a long one? Why are we doing a short one?
Yeah.
I did a short one.
You did a short one. My clinic is all about the longest possible protocol, the longest time that you can spend smashing drugs into your system. And then you started your... I remember when you did your FET, started your drugs for FET. Mm. That's frozen embryo transfer. You were like, oh yeah, I'm just like going straight on the estrogen and I'll have a transfer in a couple of weeks. And I was like, you what?
Sorry, come again? Yeah, I never got put on the pill, which I know is obviously something that happens a lot. So I don't know why.
Hopefully, I was like,
I'll find out.
Yeah, I just felt like you weren't going through it properly. I felt like you weren't.
That bitch doesn't know what it's really like.
Yeah, exactly. So Professor Tim is going to explain to us why different clinics do different things.
Why I got away with it.
Yeah, exactly, you bastard.
So a long protocol is the traditional type of IVF where the woman is downregulated using an agonist drug, and that can be given by a daily injection or a once monthly injection, or as we use at Oxford Fertility, a daily sniffer. And that drug, you take that every day. It's called an agonist. You take it every day. And after about 2 to 3 weeks, it suppresses the hormones that come from the head. So it switches everything off and it puts the woman's reproductive hormones to baseline. And you'd normally then go into your clinic and have something like a down-regulation check. It might be a down-reg blood test or a scan, something to confirm that everything is at baseline. And you would then go on to start your daily stimulation injections whilst continuing with the daily sniffer or downregulation injection, because that switches off the ability to ovulate. When we stimulate the ovaries for IVF and the follicles are getting larger, we have to obviously prevent ovulation before egg collection. So everything needs to be switched off. So you do that with in a long protocol with this daily agonist sniffer or injection for 2 or 3 weeks before starting stimulation, and then you continue it all the way up until the late night trigger. The alternative is a short protocol, and there are different ways of doing a short protocol, but the commonest current approach would be to have a short antagonist protocol. With a short antagonist protocol, on usually around day two of your period, you would start on your daily stimulation, so you don't do the downregulation drugs beforehand. So on day two of your period, you go straight on to the daily stimulation injection with a drug such as Gonalef or Menopur or one of the variations of that. And then a few days later, you have to then add in a second drug, and this is the antagonist, and it's usually given by a daily injection. And that second drug switches off the ability to ovulate. As I've just said, you have to have something to switch off the ability to ovulate. You then continue with your daily stimulation injection and your daily antagonist injection all the way up until the late night trigger, and then everything is stopped at that point. So those are the differences. The clue's in the name. A long protocol obviously takes longer than a short protocol. The main differences really are that the risk of ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, or OHSS, is significantly lower with a short antagonist protocol compared to a long agonist protocol. So some clinics will use a short antagonist protocol for women who are at increased risk of OHSS. And that's particularly women with polycystic ovaries, women with a high anti-Müllerian hormone or AMH level, younger women, women who've had OHSS beforehand. Some clinics indeed will use a short antagonist protocol for absolutely everyone. Now you might ask, well, if there's a lower risk of OHSS with a short antagonist protocol and it's shorter and quicker, why wouldn't all clinics use it for everyone? And it's a very good question, and it's probably because some previous studies did suggest a slightly higher success rate with a long agonist protocol compared to a short antagonist protocol. And because of that, a lot of clinics have been a bit wary about moving everyone over to a short antagonist protocol. But more recent studies have suggested that if there are differences, they are very, very small. So it's really a discussion to have with your clinic. They may have a preference for a certain type, long or short, for certain groups of patients. And it's something you can discuss with them. But I'm sure most clinics also, if you expressed a strong preference for one type of treatment, I'm sure that they would listen to your wishes.
That's the show, guys. If Zoe's story resonated with you, go and check out her books. I know she's got one coming out this year about pregnancy after loss, so yeah, go check those out.
Yes. Next week, we are talking to Alison Perry.
Aha! The founder of Not Another Mummy blog.
Yeah. She's talking about her journey.
Her journey.
That was a really great chat, and one of our first lockdown interviews, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Lockdown.
And it was great.
Zoom interviews. So we had a lovely chat about that. And that only leaves us to say thank you.
Thank you to Zoe.
Thank you so much to Zoe. Thank you to Liz and Nick.
Thank you to Professor Tim or Tom Cruise. I know it's called.
Professor Tim, aka Tom Cruise. Thank you to Acast.
Okay, guys. Have a more inspiring week than we had.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.